The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Rough crowd. Okay. We're here to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. Go ahead. Because it is the most momentous event in working class history. And the suggested time for this talk was 15 minutes. And I'm going to be upfront with you, I can't tell the story of the Russian Revolution in 15 minutes. And according to many people who know me well, there are a few stories that I can tell in under an hour. So I'm not going to try to paint a complete picture of the Russian Revolution. My goal instead is to try to convince you, hopefully to inspire you, to study the Russian Revolution so that each of you can go and paint that picture yourself. I want to convince you to go back to wherever you came from, form a study group, and read Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution. Or Victor Serge's Year One of the Russian Revolution. Or 10 Days That Shook the World by John Reed. I want you to read Kathy Porter's biography of Alexandra Kollontai, which is coming out. And also Nadezhda Krupskaya's Reminiscences of Lenin. I want you to organize a party and watch Reds. Okay, so these are big books, and Reds is a long movie, so I have some convincing to do. And I want to start it by talking to you about Lev Vygotsky. Lev Vygotsky was a socialist and psychologist whose ideas have influenced educators all over the world. And he was just 21 years old when the Russian Revolution happened. He developed his theories of consciousness, both in the very friendly period immediately following the revolution, but then also in the much less friendly period of Stalinism that followed it, before dying at the age of 38 of tuberculosis. If you've read anything that Vygotsky wrote, you know that it is almost impossible to believe that he was living through a civil war, a famine, and living with a very difficult disease, because all of his work has a certain breathless quality, and it's not from the tuberculosis. It's because he's just that excited. He's just that excited about the potential for human development that has been unlocked by the revolution. According to Vygotsky, the fight for socialism is necessary because, along with the liberation of the many millions of human beings from suppression, will come the liberation of the human personality from the fetters which curb its development. So I asked my friend and comrade, Jeremy, from New York, who I hope is here, who was also a fan of Vygotsky, to send me his favorite Vygotsky quotes. Being a socialist, Jeremy is generous. So instead of one, he sent me many, including the one that I just read. All of the quotes he sent me are amazing, but the one that best encapsulates why we should study the Russian Revolution is this one. We need to concentrate not on the product of development, but on the very process by which higher forms are established. For it is only in movement that a body shows what it is. Okay. Since you like that, I'll say it again. It is only in movement that a body shows what it is. The Russian Revolution, then, is crucial for us to study because it shows us the working class in movement, so that we can see what it is, what it is capable of, and why it is the only force with both the desire and the positioning to not only achieve self-emancipation, but to liberate all of humanity in the process. Vygotsky also wrote that we become ourselves through others, and that our individual capacities represent what he called the aggregate of internalized social relations. I believe this. And so to honor the collective effort that was the Russian Revolution, and that is the success of this conference, I'm going to bring in the voices of as many comrades as possible to convince you to make studying the revolution your project from now until October and beyond. And I want to start out by thanking Alex and Haley, who I met for the first time today, for letting me into the business office so that I could print out my talk. Thank you. Comrades are good about things like that. Okay, it's important first off to study and discuss the dynamics and architecture of the Russian Revolution, to know what conditions were necessary for workers, not only to rise up against their exploiters and oppressors, but also to make the great psychological leap, as Todd pointed out on Friday, Todd will be speaking after me, from resistance to power. We can see the working class and movement in resistance at many different points in history. The movement for the eight-hour day here in the United States in the 1890s, the Flint sit-down strikes of 1936 and 1937, and the teachers' strike right here in Chicago in 2012. We can see the working class moving in resistance in the Arab Spring and in the general strike in India and the 2,663 strikes in China just this past year. We can even see glimpses of the working class moving to power at the Seattle general strike in 1919 and the San Francisco general strike in 1994 and, of course, in the Paris Commune. But if we want to see the working class moving all the way to power, we really don't have any other place to look but the Russian Revolution. Only by examining the ebbs and flows of the workers' movement in Russia building up to 1917 can we understand fully the need for a revolutionary party. To act as a memory of the class and to help provide the catalyst to move the class to power. The ability of the seasoned activists of the Bolshevik Party to carry forward the lessons of the failed 1905 revolution, which they had gained through personal experience, was crucial. Because as Craig from Chicago pointed out yesterday, while it is very good to learn from your mistakes, it's even better to learn from someone else's. Study the Russian Revolution because it represents, as Jesse from Maine put it, the practical application of most of our theoretical principles. Not that our revolutionary moment will be just like theirs, but knowing the kind of decisions that they had to make and the methods by which they made them is crucial for us. It is only by studying 1917 in Russia that we can fully understand the level of democracy necessary for a successful workers' revolution. As Lily from Austin pointed out, it is their method that we have to absorb, as when on the eve of the revolution, the various garrisons reported on their readiness to take power before the decision was made. Studying the Russian Revolution allows us to fully understand not only the leadership of figures like Lenin and Trotsky, but also the revolutionaries who didn't write and so are not as easy to remember. Like the unnamed man who shook his fist in the face of a socialist revolutionary and demanded that he take power. Or Blagovanov, which I didn't say right, the comrade who raised the red lantern that signaled the revolution's start and the fact that the workers were ready to take power for themselves. It is important for us to familiarize ourselves with and try as much as we can to feel these shifts in psychology so that we can recognize them in ourselves when our time comes. It is only by studying the revolution that we can see clearly that it was nothing like the conspiratorial coup that the capitalist historians try to make us believe it was, that it was not just the leaders who were crucial to making the psychological leap to power, but the ordinary workers in their factories, for example, the Putilov Works Committee, whom Amy from New York quoted yesterday. They said, by becoming accustomed to self-management, the workers are preparing for that time when private ownership of factories and works will be abolished, and the means of production, together with the buildings built by the workers' hands, will pass into the working class as a whole. We must... Go ahead. We must study the revolution so that we can understand how to deal with the various purveyors of state violence. I asked my comrade David from San Francisco, who recently finished reading Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution, for his favorite quote, and he gave me this one, which describes the mood on the streets in the 5 days immediately preceding the revolution. The police are fierce, implacable, hated and hating foes. To win them over is out of the question. It is different with the soldiers. The crowd makes every effort to avoid hostile encounters with them. On the contrary, it seeks ways to dispose them in its favor, convince, attract, fraternize, merge them in itself. The infantry are beside one on the pavement, closer, more accessible than the Cossacks on horseback. The masses try to get near them, look into their eyes, surround them with their hot breath. A great role is played by women workers. They go up to the cordons more boldly than men. Take hold of the rifles, beseech, almost command, put down your bayonets, join us. The soldiers are excited, ashamed, exchange anxious glances, waver. Someone makes up his mind first, and the bayonets rise guiltily above the shoulders of the advancing crowd. The barrier is opened. A joyous and grateful hurrah shakes the air, and the revolution makes another forward step. It is crucial for us to understand all of these dynamics, large and small. But I think it is as, if not more, important to see what the working class and movement made possible, the immediate changes that workers and movement to power made in people's lived experiences, because we see the ruling class in movement every day, and it is not a pretty picture. Police terror, the denial of basic human rights, the gleeful deployment of weapons of mass destruction, the constant degradation of women, of LGBTQ people, of working class people of all races and oppressed people of all classes, the callous disregard for human life and the planet. The working class in movement looks quite different. The revolutionary government did more than decriminalize homosexuality, make abortion free and on demand, distribute land to the people who worked it, socialize housework, and move oppressed people to the highest positions of leadership. By doing these things immediately, it changed the way people saw themselves and the world. In the following quote, which was given to me by Dana from Chicago, Alexandra Kollontai describes returning to Russia after the February Revolution. She says, "It was the 2nd of April, 1917, my first day back in Petrograd after 8.5 years in exile. It was a completely new Russia I had returned to, without the Tsar, with a new provisional government, and sitting parallel to it, sharing power, the Soviet of workers' and soldiers' deputies. The city was charged with energy, exploding with ideas. On that gusty April morning, it was as if the wind had driven the entire population out into the streets, hurling the last scraps of their patriotism and submission into the gutter." Kollontai was an activist, a socialist, and a Bolshevik, but Boris Kostodiev was an artist, a portrait painter, and he also had nothing but praise for the events of 1917. "Here in Petrograd," wrote Kostodiev, "everything is on the boil, the streets full of people. You have to wait centuries for streets like these. Everything has shifted, moved, and many things have been turned upside down." Arthur Leray, a composer, had similar thoughts about the revolution and what it meant. "Like my friends," he wrote, "I believed in the October Revolution and immediately sided with it. We were given complete freedom in our field to do everything we wanted. It was the first time in history that there had been such an opportunity." I thank Annie from Chicago for these quotes from artists in the revolution. But perhaps most importantly, we should study the Russian Revolution to build in ourselves a sense of the working class's ability to control its own destiny. Because there's so much noise right now about the inevitability of all things awful, the inevitability of unemployment through automation, the inevitability of war and mass starvation, the inevitability of planetary destruction. But all these things are put in motion by choices. There is nothing inevitable about the shape of human society. The only thing that is inevitable is that if we don't figure out what we want and fight for it, we're not going to get it. And once we figure out what we want, Once we find our truth, as Wyoming from Los Angeles said yesterday, we must stand for it with everything we have. Finally, we should study the Russian Revolution to build our stores of beauty and of hope. We should remember that the working class of today is beaten down by the reality of capitalism and power. Our senses are dulled by trying to shut out all the stupidity and ugliness the ruling class forces on us, the divisions and hatreds that they try to pump right into our blood. But unlike the ruling class, the working class and movement is not stupid or ugly or divided or hateful. The working class in movement is united. The working class in movement is brave. The working class in movement is brilliant. And the working class in movement is beautiful. It is full of hope and love for the best of humanity. And it is from this love and this hope for humanity that we should draw our inspiration, not from our hatred and rage, although it's perfectly natural to feel both those things when we look at what capitalism is doing to people, and I know that I do. However, I also know that by examining the Russian Revolution on a granular level, we will find that the best way to build toward the next successful working class revolution is with hope and love, and a deep, abiding confidence that, unlike the ruling class in movement, we can do much better. Thank you.
Speaker, in a moment, I want to ask you to stick around for a couple of minutes after Todd speaks so we can fill folks in and sort of next steps from here. Todd Kreshen, dear friend of mine, longtime member of the ISO, frequent contributor to the Socialist Worker newspaper, and in September, his edited version of Eyewitness to the Russian Revolution will be out from Haymarket Books.
Thanks, comrades. I have a simple task this afternoon, which is to send you home to fight. And to fight from a particular point of view. I want to begin by quoting the great socialist revolutionary leader, Eugene V. Debs. He said the following: I am not a labor leader. I do not want you to follow me or follow anyone else. If you are looking for a Moses to lead you out of this capitalist wilderness, you will stay right where you are. I would not lead you into the promised land, because if I could lead you in, someone else could lead you out again. You must use your heads as well as your hands and get yourself out of your present condition. And that is a particular point of view from which we in the ISO fight every battle. We look to the self-emancipation, the self-activity, the capacity of ordinary working class people to change the world, not on behalf of somebody else, but for themselves. The great Russian revolutionary Vladimir Lenin once wrote in a book called Left-Wing Communism that the way the Russian working class fit itself to become capable of founding a new society was through 20 years of what he called suffering. And the Bolsheviks and the Russian revolutionary and the working class knew something about suffering. a defeated revolution in 1905, which pushed the Tsar halfway from power, left the Tsar in power, and he exacted a revenge on the working class to the tune of 15,000 executions, 35,000 exiles, and the obliteration of the revolutionary movement, or at least he thought. That suffering of the complexity of the mass movement, of the intensity of the political organization, of the combat, literally sometimes, but also political combat between competing political tendencies, allowed a vanguard in the Russian working class to emerge. And contrary to something you might have heard, a vanguard is not three friends who get together and decide that they are in fact the vanguard. A vanguard of the working class is tens of thousands of ordinary working class people who have absorbed the political lessons of battle against the ruling class. And only when you have layers of working class people in every factory, in every hospital, in every school, in every neighborhood, of all races, of all genders, only when you have that vanguard layer of a working class can you begin to talk about the possibility of a socialist revolution. Because again, it is the self-emancipation of the working class, not the emancipation of the working class by a small, isolated group of people. And that is the politics that we try to present here in the ISO. But if the Bolsheviks knew something about suffering, I have to say that our own working class over the last 100 years has also learned a thing or two about suffering, but also about how to fight. And so what I want to do in the next few minutes is to try to condense a few of the lessons over the last 100 years in the American working class experience and make an argument to you that if we collect those ideas and help transmit them to a new generation, that we will not be passive bystanders about what Trump and his friends want to do to us, but we will begin the process of figuring out what we want to do to him and his kind. So there's just a few highlights. Between 1912 and 1919, the classic period of the rise of the American Socialist Party when Eugene V. Debs was running for president, there were 21,000 strikes between 1916 and 1921. The most common way that a regular person participated in any sort of social movement was by going on strike with their coworkers. That is what created the conditions for the rise of a socialist party to the tune of 100,000 people or more, in which Eugene Debs got 6% of the vote in 1912 and became the target of the Democratic Party. So the mass strike wave is one aspect of that period. The second aspect of that period is what we refer to as the Great Migration. Hundreds of thousands and then millions of African Americans moving from the Deep South into the very heart of industrial capitalism in the United States and remaking the face of the working class at the very heart and center of the most profitable bourgeoisie that has ever existed in the history of the world. And for their audacity to move off the sharecropping and move into the industrial centers, they were met with the most vicious type of repression and violence. They knew a thing or two about suffering. In East St. Louis, white mobs burnt their neighborhoods, killed hundreds of people. But in 1919, in this city, when white mobs attacked the black working class in its neighborhoods, they had learned the lessons of fighting in a war, in the First World War. They learned the lessons of self-defense. And if they took casualties, they gave it just as they got, just as good as they got. So that period of 1919, the other thing that happened in 1919 is that here in this city, the Communist Party was founded. Sort of a difficult history to get to about exactly how it happened, but let's just say for today that in 1919, in Chicago, the Communist Party was founded. Tens of thousands of people absorbed the lessons that Elizabeth spoke about and said, we will do in the United States what our comrades in Russia did. We will help lead the working class to emancipate itself. That is a lesson that we have to transmit to our friends in the new mass movement. But the problem is, a great French revolutionary, Saint-Just, once said that if you make a revolution halfway, you dig your own grave. And by threatening the ruling class in 1919, the repression that was brought down on the heads of the radical workers in the black movement, it was a terrible thing to see. The Ku Klux Klan, by 1924, had 1 million members in the United States. You can go on the internet and look at the pictures of thousands of hooded Klansmen marching in profile, marching in line in a disciplined manner on the White House, as most of the Democratic Party stood by and cheered. Woodrow Wilson, who had been the president when Debs was imprisoned, led the cleansing of the civil service, the public civil service, eliminating black workers' opportunities to get jobs. This was the sort of repression that people were facing. They also started something they called, I think this is, Donald Trump would probably adopt this, they called it the American Plan. Donald Trump calls it Make America Great Again. But this notion of repression for the working class, cutting taxes on businesses, wiping out the unions, and reestablishing the authority of the bosses in every factory, in every hospital, in every school, that is what you suffer if you don't defeat them. And that's what happened in that period. Mass struggles, but then a backlash. Fast forward the film a little bit to the 1930s. We're very familiar with the New Deal, the way it's portrayed as, out of the goodness of his heart, Franklin Delano Roosevelt thought up a bunch of great ideas about making some reforms. And those reforms were very important. Actually, we still have some of them today. We have something called the National Labor Relations Board. We have something called Social Security, both of which Donald Trump would essentially like to get rid of. But those are important reforms that didn't come in a vacuum. They came because Roosevelt faced extreme protest, extreme opposition on his left flank. And he was driven to do things that he didn't plan on doing to begin with. The Communist Party in this period grows from 10,000 people in 1929 to some 80 or 100,000 people by 1938. In the heart of the industrial battles against the bosses and unemployment and against racism in the United States and for the integration of a working class that could build multiracial unions and fight the bosses. That is what created the conditions under which Roosevelt began to grant some reforms. But just like in the earlier period, if you make a revolution halfway, they take their revenge on you. In this city again, in 1938, during a massive steel strike, the police were called out by the bosses and they shot workers down in the back, killing strikers on the picket lines. Roosevelt's response was a plague on both your houses. To say to the bosses and to the police, it's open season on the working class now. So the New Deal that was a promise, was a response to the radical protests on the left, ended with Roosevelt withdrawing public financing for the Public Works Administration, withdrawing unemployment insurance, cutting budgets, and that led to a new recession. What really ended the Great Depression was World War II, which is another aspect of the reaction that we faced. Fast forward the film again, the middle of the 1960s. The Black Rebellion is in full motion. People fighting for their civil rights, demanding liberation. The Soldiers' Revolt in Vietnam, bringing to a close what had been, up until that point, the longest and bloodiest war in American history. We are now, this is year 16 in Afghanistan, but until that point, Vietnam had been the longest U.S. foreign occupation. The Soldiers' Revolt, ordinary working class soldiers refusing to fight in Vietnam. And, of course, the execution, the assassination of Martin Luther King in 1968 led to an absolute uprising in cities across the country. As people said, we will not wait any longer. We demand our liberation now. Again, inspirational struggles. Refer back to what Elizabeth was talking, the Bolsheviks. For them, that was all compressed into a 20-year period. For us, this long period of struggle and then reaction, the last period of reaction, unfortunately, we're still living under today. After the black movement, after the industrial workers' uprising in the 1970s, after the Soldiers' Revolt, the American government came back with a plan, just like the American plan in the 1920s, just like a plague on both your houses in the late 1930s. They came back with the war on drugs, mass incarceration, and neoliberalism. And almost everybody in this room, that those realities have shaped your entire life. All you have ever known is neoliberalism. All you have ever known is mass incarceration. All you have ever known is an unending war on drugs, and now exported to a permanent war overseas. A whole generation of people has literally grown up not having the experience of seeing anyone in their family participate in a victorious strike. having not seen anybody in their family participate in winning a whole new realm of civil rights legislation. In fact, what we have seen is defeat and defeat and defeat. Suffering, as Lenin put it. And it's the lesson that I want to condense out of all those experiences. The great German revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg said it this way. She said, some people want to counterpose reform and revolution. We shouldn't counterpose them. We don't want reform or revolution. We want reform and revolution. So if we get the reforms, but they keep the power, then it's only a matter of time that they come back to take the reforms away. And sometimes they don't just take what you won away from you, but they push you down even further. That is what has shaped our lives. But thankfully, we're now living in a new time. All I have to do is say a few things, and I won't even go through the details. The day without an immigrant in 2006. The victorious fight for equal marriage. The uprising in Wisconsin. The Chicago teacher strike. The Seattle teacher strike. Occupy. Black Lives Matter. It's very easy to be a historian when you are living in the middle of history. And you know what? Millions of people know exactly what you're talking about. We used to have this, some of us used to be obsessed with poetry, and we even named one of the websites after it, We Are Many. There's an old Percival Shelley poem that says, ye are many, they are few. That's where it comes from. The new generation adopted its own slogan. The 99% versus the 1%. It's the same damn thing. The continuity is incredible because that's what the struggle teaches us. There is a new cycle of struggle which has begun, and it began even before the Donald stumbled into office. But he is intensifying the cycle. He is doubling down on the far right, the Muslim ban, the attack on women, the destruction of the EPA, the attacks on Planned Parenthood, etc. But our side is in the fight. The mass women's march, the airport occupations, the huge demonstrations against climate change, and yes, the AT&T mobility strike. Not the biggest strike in the history of the United States, but nonetheless, for the first time, a couple tens of thousands of young workers learning what it's like to be on a picket line. And that is our future, comrades. And it's not just happening here in the United States. You look around the world, and Trump has his reflection in Narendra Modi in India, in Temer in Brazil, in Capriles in Venezuela, in Le Pen in France, and El Sisi in Egypt. The same dynamics that are happening to us are happening to people around the world. So a new cycle of protest and response and repression has begun. The lessons of reform and revolution, the lessons of the co-optive powers of the Democratic Party, the lessons that you cannot win socialism without liberation for the oppressed, and that you cannot win liberation for the oppressed without socialism, transforming our resistance and our protests into new forms of power that can defeat and hold the ground on the process to remaking the system. These are the lessons that we have to bring to a new generation of people. Really, comrades, if we want to take on the powers that be in this country, we need a revolutionary party that numbers in the hundreds of thousands of people. We have a couple thousand here today. That's a very good start. But the Revolutionary Party won't just come from the people in these rooms. It will come from the experiences of hundreds of thousands of people learning how to emancipate themselves from the claws of this system. Those future struggles will create the context in which hundreds of thousands of people will open their minds to the lessons of history. We want to be involved in every one of those struggles that we possibly can. We want to be the people who are arguing the case for the basic lessons of the class struggle that I put forward. We want to be the people who are doing everything we can to fuse all of the different struggles together. But we also understand that other political currents are going to make their own decisions. They're going to build their own organizations. They're going to struggle alongside us. And in the creation of a new mass revolutionary left, we want to be an important part of that. So we say to our friends who are trying to build the Democratic Socialists of America that we wish you well. We have disagreements about certain aspects. We wish you learn how to fight. We hope you stick up for yourselves. We hope you're not pushed around. We hope you learn how to fight for yourselves and develop your own ideas. And even if they're a little bit different than our ideas, in struggle together, we will fight the real enemy, and we will decide in practice which ideas make more sense. To get to an organization, to get to a revolutionary party of hundreds of thousands, requires the sorts of social conditions that made it possible in the past. There is no way to build a mass revolutionary party in the United States when we have 7 or 8 strikes per year. We must return to the period that we saw before World War I, when it was common for workers to band together, to fight the boss, and walk out. That is the only context in which we can rebuild a mass revolutionary party. But it is a context that if we do not return to, we will not be able to defend ourselves. And I believe that more and more people are looking to those lessons today. Now, for 40 years, the left has suffered a series of splits and debilitating defeats. Not because leftists, although sometimes people will say this, and maybe there's a small element of truth, that we're a contentious bunch. That might have an element of truth to it. But the real reason the revolutionary left has been in a crisis for the last 40 years is because the capitalist class has been on a rampage, that it has destroyed the unions, it has destroyed civil rights, it has put millions of young people in prison and told them that their lives do not matter a dime. It has told women that you go back to the kitchen, that we will take away our abortion rights. It has told people around the world that the most important thing you know about the United States is what size our bombs are. This is the context in which the defeats have created the decline of the left. I believe, and I sometimes can be a pessimist, but I really believe that we are seeing a new cycle, that the tide is turning, that this generation that created Occupy and Black Lives Matter will not submit without a fight. And in those struggles, we are going to create a new mass revolutionary left. So what should we do if we want to leave this conference and begin to fight? Specifically, what do? We go back to our branches and we learn how to form united fronts to defend ourselves, to defend our friends, and to fight for the rights that we deserve, be they union rights, abortion rights, the struggle for free speech against the attacks of the far right. We have to build united fronts and we have to learn how to fight. We can learn from others and we can teach other people, but there's no way to build a socialist movement outside the context of struggle. Everybody here has to go home and learn how to organize and learn how to fight. That's the first thing. The second thing is that we fight in a particular way. We have a particular attitude towards organization. The strength of the ISO is in its branches. It is wonderful to come here and see thousands of people. It's really is wonderful. That's all you can say about it. It's inspiring. It's much harder to go back to Athens, Ohio, or to San Diego. I won't go through the roll call. But to go back to much smaller numbers of people and figure out how are you going to maintain your focus on patiently building up the forces of a revolutionary organization. And I'll just say one thing. Danny came up here and gave a plug for Socialist Worker. Without Socialist Worker, we will not rebuild a revolutionary left. If we cannot teach a generation of people to go and proudly convince other people, be they coworkers, fellow students, family members, people in the neighborhood, people you meet on the street, if we cannot build a generation of people who says the mainstream media They call for violence against our side. They call for the acceptance of neoliberalism. They lie to your face. That's what the mainstream media does. If you want the truth about what's really happening and how to fight it, then buy this paper. I should have a copy in my hand. Then buy Socialist Worker. And if you can't stand up for yourself and convince another person to take you seriously enough to stand there and have a discussion about Socialist Worker, you've got some work to do. So the putting the paper at the heart of our operation is absolutely critical. Okay, two more things and I'll stop. The final thing is we have a battle of ideas and we have to join that battle. The last thing I want to say, and this is not always the most popular word, and it may not be the most inspiring way to end a talk, but I wanted to talk about discipline. Not in the sense of, I'm going to tell you what to do. But if you want to build a revolutionary party for the coming decades, because that's how long the struggle is going to take, you have to develop in yourself a revolutionary self-discipline and a commitment to your comrades to participate in debates and discussions and act as a collective democratically, but act as a collective nonetheless. The discipline it takes to suffer defeats, as Lenin referred to, the discipline it takes to go through the down periods, and the discipline it takes not to get carried away when things begin to turn in our favor, the discipline it takes to maintain the course towards the self-emancipation of the working class. Without that self-instilled discipline, we will not be capable of building an organization that can withstand the twists and turns that we are about to face. Martin Luther King, the night before Martin Luther King was assassinated, he said the following. He said, something is happening in Memphis. Something is happening in our world. And you know, if I were standing at the beginning of time with the possibility of taking a kind of general and panoramic view of the whole of human history up to now, and the Almighty said to me, Martin Luther King, which age would you like to live in? I would take my mental flight by Egypt, and I would watch God's children in their magnificent trek from the dark dungeons of Egypt through, or rather across the Black Sea, through the wilderness, on towards the Promised Land. And in spite of its magnificence, I wouldn't stop there. Notice the reference, Debs, the Promised Land. From here, he imagines talking to Plato and Aristotle and Socrates, and he imagines seeing Martin Luther nail his theses on the door in the church in Wittenberg. And he imagines Lincoln signing the Emancipation Proclamation, which I think is a particularly poignant moment to have been at. And then King says, he thinks about it, and he says, strangely enough, I would turn to the Almighty and say, if you allow me to live just a few years in the second half of the 20th century, I will be happy. And what he meant by that was that he put himself in that moment, in that time, and understood that human societies are created by certain forces and they can be recreated by other forces. But forces are not abstract. Forces are composed of people. And he had a duty not to wish he lived somewhere else, not to wish for an easier or a better time, but in fact to put his feet where he landed and learn how to fight. I just came from the last session we had was Comrade Luis Rangel from the Revolutionary Workers' Party in Mexico speaking. And he talked about the criminal violence perpetrated by the state against the people of Mexico. And it brought most of the room to tears, including myself. So I'm going to try to get through this without crying, because I already cried. Our comrade Julio is sitting here in the front row. Julio. In Nicaragua. He said, I joined the Sandinistas because the Somoza dictatorship ran rampant through the country, killing us. But I look at the violence in Mexico today, and it is more terrifying than the violence we faced during the Sandinista Revolution. And he said, if you understand what this ruling class is doing to the people of Mexico, and what this ruling class intends to do to the people of the United States, and has already done to people around the world, then you understand that you have a duty to join the revolutionary movement. We in this country must build a movement that can stay the hand of the American ruling class as it threatens our friends around the country, around the world. He said, it's our job to make it a little less hard for the comrades in Mexico to do what they have to do against their own ruling class. And then he said something very simple. He said, if you haven't joined the ISO yet, What are you waiting for?
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.